months after talking with my father and sister, I again struggled with my terror of flying. That evening I made my second reservation to fly to Hawaii, leaving the afternoon of the 6th. Again, I didn't tell Dad I was coming. Events lay before me in a haze. I would go to the airport and get on the plane, entirely sober. Drunkenness would only make it worse, would intensify my fear, I thought. With any luck at all, I would arrive in Hawaii, where I would telephone my parents and surprise them. It didn't make a lot of sense. Wasn't thought out at all. But Jan told Dad about my plans, and he said for me not to come, that there was nothing I could do. And besides, Mom was adamant that she didn't want a big deathbed scene. Dad said he had just read Mom a letter from a friend of hers, but she had trouble concentrating on the words, only picking up bits and pieces. Mom gave Dad a list of things she wanted him to do after she was gone, and made him promise to do them. It was a long list, he said, and involved us. I spoke to Bruce, who said he had been told by Dad, pursuant to Mom's wishes, not to rush to Hawaii for a big ending scene. Mom didn't want drama. She just wanted peace. I tried to sleep that night, but couldn't. I got up and tried to write, then tried to read, then tried to watch a late movie on television. I couldn't remain in bed either. Finally, I dozed off on the family room couch, holding a letter she had written to me. On the morning of the 7th, I called Dad early, afraid of what I might hear. Mom had slipped into a coma and was not expected to survive the night. He said it was her last wish to be cremated, with her ashes scattered on the land she loved, Kawaloa. He said he would come back to Seattle after it was all over. And he spoke of one of the items on her long list. She made me promise to finish Chapter House and get her off to New York. But I can't do it here. He said it was a little over half completed, and that he had read many of the passages to Mom, receiving her comments and suggestions on them. In a failing voice, I asked if she might possibly pull through, but he said no. It was beyond that. I broke down and couldn't talk anymore. Since she was in a coma, she wasn't going to fight back again, as she had so many times before. This was finality. I went in the family room and hugged Margot while I cried. I asked Julie and Kim to pray for their Nana. I hadn't given them any details yet, feeling my daughters were too young to sense the immensity of what was going on. Early that evening, Dad called. My mother, Beverly Ann Herbert, passed away at 5:05 p.m. at the age of 57, while he was holding her hand. Dr. Milton Howell was in attendance, and he said when she was gone, she had grace. My father told me that after my call that morning, he held Mom's hand and told her I said I loved her. She was in a coma, but he told her, "If you understand, darling, nod your head." She nodded her head. I was only a little heartened when Dad assured me she was not in pain at the end. They weren't going to spread her ashes yet, as it was Mom's wish that the ceremony, a simple one, be held at a future date at Kawaloa when the entire family could be there. After the call, I told the girls, and we all cried. I learned later that in her last days my mother had remarked, "I wish Brian were here." It is a tragedy that I was not there, and I think I shall always suffer for it. What an astounding woman my mother was. What a terrible loss to me and to everyone who knew and loved her. She had a valiant, strong heart. And I recalled some 2 decades earlier, when we were living in San Francisco before the phenomenal success of Dune, when Mom predicted that she would die in a distant land. A story on Mom's passing ran in Retail Adweek, describing her career in retail advertising and featuring Dr. Howell's description of her as a woman with grace. Dad wrote a poignant poem about their life together, which he entitled, "With the Simple Elegance That Represented My Mother, Bev." It spoke of their honeymoon on a mountaintop and little details about their life together, spanning nearly 38 years. In reference to the cause of her lung cancer, he wrote, "Smoke buys your life." In the closing lines of the poem, my father described their final moments together when he held her hand. Bev. My God, there's a bear. Black nose in fireweed, silver forest in your eyes, cold ground beneath our bed. Making love on a mountaintop, a good place to begin. You fear the hum of bees, a pack rat's beady eyes. Saliva smell on your cheek, stain of huckleberry there, black as a lover's night, the color of your hair. White witch knows her man. You will fall in love with a younger woman, soft and hard and eager. Our bed smells of aloe vera, sweetness in the spines. Your shape in the pillow, moans of the summer dark. One puff kills a bird. Smoke buys your life. It rushes over the brink, waterfall of blinding light. Eyelids flicker twice, your hand in mine. Trembles when you die. Nothing is ever lost. Chapter 39. Her Plan Revealed. On Saturday, February 11th, 1984, I jogged in the morning, running from my house up a hill to the top of Mercer Island. It was windy and rainy, but the cover of woods at the top of the hill offered some shelter. That afternoon, Jan, Kim, and I met Dad and Penny at Boeing Field in Seattle. They came in on a long, sleek Israeli Westwind private jet that Dad said cost almost $20,000 to charter. I learned later that this plane, a 12-seat twin-engine turbojet, had originally been reserved for by Dad in order to fly Mom back to the mainland to see their children and grandchildren. Unfortunately, she never felt up to such a trip. He couldn't bear to ride a commercial jet back from Hawaii with all the cheerful, talkative vacationers. Another option he considered but rejected would have been to reserve the entire first-class section of a commercial airliner. Jan thought he looked thinner than he had only a few weeks before, and Dad said he had lost nearly 20 pounds in a short period of time. His face appeared flushed, especially the top of his forehead. A shade of red that looked like high blood pressure, but actually was from overexposure to the intense Hawaiian sun. His eyes were deeply set in their sockets and filled with pain. He looked devastated, as if he had been shot through the heart. Nothing in his life had ever hit him that hard. We had two cars, as Dad had 500 pounds of luggage, files, and other items to go to Port Townsend. I had made arrangements to accompany Dad and Penny to the house, having taken 2 weeks off work to help them. Jan couldn't take the time off from school. We filled the cars, then headed for Port Townsend. We ate dinner at Lido's restaurant in Port Townsend, which served good Mexican food. Dad talked a little about Mom, and said before falling silent about her, Bev was Fay. It was a reference to her supernatural and spiritual powers, including her ability to see into the future. He had a Carta Blanca beer with the meal, and as he finished the beer, he said there were many things Mom wanted taken care of after she was gone. His gaze was remote, as if he still imagined himself at Kawaloa with her, and he said, I have all these things I've made promises to her about. Promises I have to keep. She had mapped out his entire year of 1984 and beyond, with lists of things to keep him busy, to pull him through. Her first wish, she didn't want any of us to cry for her, though she must have known we would. This was an impossible request, it seemed to me. We weren't tough enough to comply. As Frank Herbert wrote in the Chapter House Dune tribute to her, she recognized tears as part of our animal origins. The dog howls at the loss of its master. Her second request was just as difficult for me to hear. She wanted Dad to remarry, didn't want him to spend the rest of his life alone. Third, he was supposed to talk with the children, Penny, Bruce, and me, about our futures, helping us wherever possible. In this category, Dad promised Mom he would write a book with me. And since my mother had grown so close to Jan, Dad said he would help her with her interior design career. Fourth, Dad was supposed to talk privately with all the grandchildren about their futures, providing them with advice and financial assistance as needed. Next, she wanted him to ask family members for assistance with all the support work involved in his writing, keeping accounts in order, answering fan letters, maintaining his schedule, and the like. It was her hope, my father told me, that I might be able to perform many of the tasks she had done, and that Bruce and Penny might assist. I assured him that we would do whatever we could. As her sixth request, she wanted Dad to purchase a house near Jan and me on Mercer Island. Sensing her plan when she was still alive, he had resisted this previously, but now he was committed to do it. Her seventh request, finish Chapter House Dune. This was proving difficult for him, since she had been so involved in the creation of the book, but he would do his best. Number eight, she did not want a funeral with her body on display. Instead, she desired cremation and a modest ceremony held at Kawaloa, with family members present. Her ashes were to be spread by the shore beneath a large sweeping kamani tree. It was a species considered sacred by Hawaiians, one that produced small round fruit from which oil could be obtained. At the ceremony, the Simon and Garfunkel song Bridge Over Troubled Water would be sung by a Hana friend and professional musician with a beautiful voice, Danny Estacada. This song represented what my father and mother had become for one another. Bridges over troubled waters. Ninth, because she felt Group Health Hospital had extended her life by nearly a decade, she wanted Dad to coordinate a special benefit showing of the Dune movie when it came out, with the proceeds going to Group Health. Mom also wanted him to telephone some of the doctors who had been most instrumental in her survival, including the radiologist who had cured her cancer while inadvertently damaging her heart with radiation. She wanted this doctor in particular to know she felt he had done his best with the medical technology available at the time. Lastly, it was her hope that the Kawaloa property might be kept in the family and used by her children and grandchildren for many years. Toward this end, she and Dad had taken certain steps in setting up their estates. After Dad went to bed at around 7:30 that night, Penny stayed up to talk with me. We sat on the recliner chairs in the reading area by the kitchen, and she told me how difficult it had been at Kawaloa, and how worried she was about Dad. He had been getting up in the middle of the night for months, unable to sleep. In her final days, Mom stopped eating. Dad tried with only limited success to force-feed her. I learned later that dying people often stopped eating, the almost unconscious act of a body that knew it was going to pass on. Penny also said Mom was extremely worried about how Bruce would fare in the future. She felt Penny and I were set up better financially than our little brother, and that we were stronger than he was. Mom and Dad had discussed hiring a business manager for him to give him financial planning advice. It troubled Mom as well that Bruce had not found a lifelong companion, and that he was exposing himself to grave dangers in the gay community. The rest of us, especially Penny, had also been concerned about this. That evening I slept in the living room, on an inflatable mattress. This was the room at Xanadu where I had spent so many enjoyable hours with my parents, discussing all manner of fascinating subjects. I was beneath the high gable with stained glass windows that my father had designed, the rooster and writer's quill, and had my mattress pulled up next to the couch that he and I had sat upon while working on my manuscripts. It was quiet. I wept for my mother and prayed for my father, and it seemed to me that there could be no greater love story than the way my parents felt for one another, no greater story of sacrifices each made for the other. I was proud to be their son. At 4:30 Sunday morning, I was awakened by clattering noises in the next room, the master bedroom. The door was partially open, with a light visible. I went inside, where I found Dad going through Mom's things. He said he had to clear everything out, that he was too upset when he encountered items that had been precious to her, and he wanted to get the pain over with. He had a dresser drawer open, and was putting her clothing and jewelry in boxes and large white plastic bags. Dad showed me a long letter from his accountant, Marilyn Niwau of Hawaii, with all sorts of information she needed to prepare the 1983 tax return. A short while later, I started on the paperwork in Mom's office. I found nearly 3 years of backlog in there, with tax records in disarray, unanswered fan, business, and personal letters, and a dizzying assortment of bank statements, undocumented deposits and withdrawals, and receipts. Only a few had Dad's notations on them concerning what they had been for. I set to organizing everything into existing file folders, and created new folders where necessary. Mom had been very organized before becoming too ill to keep up, and I'd had no idea that she had been forced to let so much go. When I saw the state of the records, I told my father I would return to Port Townsend on weekends to help until he could find a secretary. At mid-morning, the three of us decided to go for a walk. Dad wore a heavy sweater and a blue Gore-Tex coat, and when he stepped outside, even though it wasn't that cold, in the high 40s, he zipped and tied the coat, with the collar tight around his bearded mouth. "My blood is still thin from Hawaii," he said. On farm roads and forest trails near the house, Dad talked more about Mom, saying he averaged only 3 hours sleep a night during the last months of her life. With a chuckle, he spoke of her skill with comeback lines and suggested that I might have inherited her talent. He referred to my book, Classic Comebacks, and to an incident he had been told about at the Norwescon science fiction convention the prior year, when I dispatched a rude panelist in front of hundreds of people. The audience had cheered me. The following day, Penny and I did more paperwork in Mom's office and ran several errands for Dad. Since Penny offered to undertake the task of answering all fan mail from then on, I separated out all such unanswered correspondence for her. That afternoon, Dad and I sat in his study loft, where I described my Man of Two Worlds plot ideas for him. He liked them. It had taken me 2 months to work them up, and I was heartened by his reception. He said I was now a professional writer, and that I had made excellent progress in a relatively short period of time. Later that evening, I heard my father crying in his loft. When I went up there and put my arm on his shoulder, he showed me something Mom had left in his desk, a tiny white slip from a Chinese fortune cookie. It said, "With patience, you will find happiness." "It hurts so bad," he said, "and I can't do anything about it." I remembered helping my mother up a long stairway the previous September to the Seattle shops where she left her watch and bought 2 Canadian gold coins, so I knew she hadn't climbed easily to Dad's writing loft. It must have taken her an excruciatingly long time, probably in the middle of the night when she couldn't sleep. She must have paused to catch her breath after each step. When my brave mother sensed that she would never return to Port Townsend, she left things for Dad. Here and there in his study over the next few days, on the tops of books, on the windowsill, or in a box of computer paper, he found other fortune cookie messages. And he found other things she left, including a shiny lucky penny in a tiny red envelope with Chinese characters on it. The next day, Valentine's Day, Penny helped me with some of the paperwork. The filing and searching seemed endless. At low tide that evening, Dad, Bill Ransom, and I took buckets, shovels, and flashlights and went clam and oyster digging at Marrowstone Island. We brought back a nice haul, which we planned to share later in the week when Jan arrived with Bruce and the kids. The next morning, I jogged at sunrise. Then more filing and searching for tax records. Dad and I typed a 2-page outline on Man of Two Worlds and sent it off to our agents in New York. When he was typing the outline, he typed, "By Frank Herbert and Brian Herbert." Then he looked at me and asked, "Is that all right?" He was referring to the placement of his name first. I nodded. Dad wrote Mom's birth and death dates in her Bible, which had been passed on to her by her father. The cover was coming apart. So I repaired it. Penny, Dad, and I took walks each day. We made plans to meet at Kawaloa in February 1985 to conduct a service for Mom. I would take a ship, while the others would fly. Dad wanted to be certain that I could be there, since it was one of my mother's specific wishes. Dad's face, particularly his forehead, was scaly and blotchy, which he said was caused in large part by medication a doctor had given him for his Hawaiian sunburn. Tests indicated that he did not have melanoma, but that was an ever-present concern since he was fair-skinned, and he would need close monitoring. "It's better than skin cancer," he said. Frank Herbert was beginning work again on Chapter House Dune, and hoped to have it completed by the middle of March. He said it was difficult going, like fighting a headwind, but he was doing his best. At the end of each day's work, he printed the hard copy. The printer made squawking and clicking noises. Friday morning, I found one of Mom's messages in the top drawer of her desk, where I was doing bookkeeping. It was on a Chinese restaurant's matchbook and read, "A long life to you." I showed it to Dad. He smiled gently and said, without hesitation, "That was left for you, Brian." I knew he was right, and recalled so many little things she had said to me in our final months together. Her tones of voice, her gestures with her hands and arms, the way she turned her head and looked at me and smiled. All were clues to deciphering the puzzle my mother had left. My mother's plan, as it became clear, had been laid out with the meticulous care and attention to detail of a mystery writer setting up a plot. Her plan was selfless. It was difficult working where she had worked, constantly seeing her handwriting, her thoughts, her wishes. It was especially hard seeing old records so carefully organized with meticulous loving care, contrasting with recent records in such disarray. She hadn't complained about her workload, hadn't wanted to give up her work. Dad was extremely thoughtful in his time of greatest grief. When Jan arrived with Bruce, Dad gave her a book about Monet that my mother had ordered before her death. For Bruce, Penny, and me, he had an Omni magazine photograph of him and Mom enlarged, reproduced in three copies and framed. In the color photograph, my parents looked very happy, with Dad in his full beard and she nuzzling against his neck. He also gave each of us a signed 1,100-word piece he had written about their life together, written at Kawaloa the day after Mom's death. In 1985, the prose piece would appear as a testimonial in Chapter House Dune, eliciting an outpouring of supportive letters from fans. It roughly paralleled the poem he had written, Bev. True to the way he wrote much of his prose, two of the passages in the dedication in particular reveal what my father did for my mother and what they meant to one another. In her final days, she did not want anyone but me to touch her. But our married life had created such a bond of love and trust, she often said the things I did for her were as though she did them. Though I had to provide the most intimate care, the care you would give an infant, she did not feel offended, nor that her dignity had been assaulted. When I picked her up in my arms to make her more comfortable or bathe her, Bev's arms always went around my shoulders, and her face nestled, as it often had, in the hollow of my neck. Is it any wonder that I look back on our years together with a happiness transcending anything words can describe? Is it any wonder I do not want or need to forget one moment of it? Most others merely touched her life at the periphery. I shared it in the most intimate ways, and everything she did strengthened me. It would not have been possible for me to do what necessity demanded of me during the final 10 years of her life, strengthening her in return, had she not given of herself in the preceding years, holding back nothing. I consider that to be my great good fortune, and most miraculous privilege. I spent all day Sunday working on the accounts in Mom's office. Late in the evening, after Dad had gone to bed, I emerged and told Bruce, Penny, and Jan that the list from the accountant, when added to the dismal paperwork involving my mother's death, was overwhelming. I could envision an impossible workload in the future, in addition to my responsibilities as an insurance agent, writer, husband, and father. I could do the filing for Dad and write checks, but it was clear that he needed a bookkeeper in Port Townsend to help out. We all agreed to talk with him about it in the morning. I didn't sleep well that night. At one point, around 5:30 a.m., totally exhausted and nearly forgetting how much my father needed my help, I almost got in my car to drive home alone. Jan stopped me. Later, we discussed the situation with Dad, and he agreed to bring in a bookkeeper to help me. One day, while working in his loft study, Dad heard me downstairs and came down. "Did I hear footprints down here?" he said with a smile. So that we might spend more time together, Dad and I went to a bicycle shop in Seattle one day, and each of us purchased new mountain bikes with fat tires. His was silver, a 15-speed with every gizmo the store could cram on the bike. Mine was bright red, a more practical 12-speed. We broke the bikes in on a sunny day in Port Townsend at the end of February. We cycled around North Beach, a 6.5-mile trip from the house over hilly roads. Dad walked up some of the hills, while I pedaled up and then waited for him each time at the top. On the first downhill stretch, he took off like a kamikaze, going at a speed that left me far behind and apprehensive for his safety. He didn't touch the brakes at all, and said he thought he reached 40 miles an hour. It looked like a lot more to me. Perhaps he was being competitive, showing me the old man still had it. But even more, it revealed the risk-taker in him, and his youthful enthusiasm for life. Before Penny returned to California, she asked several of his friends to be sure and spend a lot of time with him after we left. She was concerned about how he would feel being alone in the house for the first time. I stayed with Dad until February 27th, and as I loaded my luggage into my car, he thanked me for the help. He placed his right hand on top of my open car door, and I touched his hand. Then, when he pulled his hand free and extended it to shake mine, we couldn't get coordinated, and a clumsy slapstick maneuver took place until finally we grasped hands in the manner of modern school kids, sort of a hip handshake achieved accidentally. Dad gave me a slender briefcase during my stay, which I opened on the ferry while crossing from Bainbridge Island to Seattle. Inside I found a note in Dad's handwriting, probably forgotten by him there. It was the last stanza of The Waking, a poem by Theodore Retke, one of the poets he most admired. The final lines read, "I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go." On the other side of the paper, my father had written the last line of another Retke poem, Four for Sir John Davies, a work he had quoted more completely in Heretics of Doom. This last line was, I knew, one of his favorites in all of poetry. "The word outleaps the world, and light is all." Chapter 40. Live Your Life. The greatest hell one can know is to be separated from the one you love. Bill Moyers. Proceeding with loving care, my father complied with each of the wishes on my mother's list. While doing so, he often said, as if she were still alive, "Bev is a white witch. I'm in big trouble if I don't do what I'm supposed to do." He gave advice to all of us and told us to trust our instincts, our gut feelings. "If you feel sick to your stomach about something," he said, "your body is talking to you. Listen to it." This advice was similar to his writings, to the inner awareness of the Bene Gesserit of Dune, and to the statements of Leto II in Children of Dune, when he said, "You have felt thoughts in your head. Your descendants will feel thoughts in their bellies." And, "It is time humans learned once more to live in their instincts." Dad developed a special relationship with Julie, who turned 16 in April 1984. He took her to the American Booksellers Association convention in Washington, D.C., where she was thrilled to meet entertainers Raquel Welch and Mr. T. She also watched my father deliver a speech at a big breakfast banquet. When Julie returned from the East Coast, she said her grandfather was referred to as the Big Ragu by New York publishing people. Frank Herbert spent quality time with his other grandchildren, including a writing session with Kim, then 12, critiquing stories she had written on a word processor at school. Margot, only 2, was too young for a heart-to-heart conversation, but she and her grandfather developed a close mutual affection. Initially, he asked her to call him Panona, which had been my mother's request of Julie and Kim in the 1970s. Just as that name had not stuck in the earlier attempt, it failed again, as Margot misunderstood and referred to him as Banana. No, we would all exclaim, breaking up with laughter. Panona! She couldn't quite get it, and finally we encouraged her to call him Grandpa. This evolved in her young mind, and Margot settled on calling him Pop-Pop, which he loved. Every time we went to see Pop-Pop, she became very excited and often took him drawings and colorings she had done. He particularly liked her depiction of a spaceship filled with aliens, which he put up on the kitchen bulletin board. Based on our outline for Man of Two Worlds, G.P. Putnam's sons made a substantial offer, which we accepted and split evenly. With this, another of the promises my father made to my mother was on track. However, since Dad was busy providing technical advice and promotional assistance on the Dune movie, scheduled for release in December 1984, and on the writing of screenplays for two of his other works in which producers had expressed recent interest, The Santa Rosa Barrier and Soul Catcher, I was left with the task of doing most of the work on our book during 1984. Dad thought we might be able to begin work on the project without distractions in the spring of 1985, with completion expected by the end of that summer. On the same day that our Putnam offer came in, I received an offer from another publisher, Arbor House, to publish Sudana Sudana in hardcover. A third publisher, Berkeley Books, was making an offer on the paperback rights for this book. My agent, Clyde Taylor, said, in an understatement, "This is your day." He also said my first United States hardcover contract was a breakthrough for me, a real boost to my career. I told Clyde to go ahead and accept the offers. A few weeks later, I received and accepted offers from W.H. Allen to publish Sudana Sudana in the United Kingdom, in hardcover and paperback. In the spring of 1984, Jan and I spent every other weekend in Port Townsend, and she helped me with the accounts. A local bookkeeper had been selected, but her duties were limited to balancing the books monthly. Plenty of other work remained. Sometimes we handled things without asking Dad. On other occasions, we accumulated items and asked him if he wanted to attend such and such a conference, or if he wanted to donate to particular causes, or if he wanted to deliver a speech in San Francisco and the like. Occasionally, he asked me to send signed copies of Dune or other Frank Herbert titles to people unsolicited, as a way of thanking them for favors. Much of the time, if I asked him for financial information or the location of certain needed documentation, his eyes would glaze over and he would stiffen, unable to respond. He seemed to be wishing he were somewhere far away, or that I would just take care of it for him without asking. One weekend before leaving Port Townsend, I told him it was necessary to transfer $100,000 between his accounts the following week. He made the withdrawals correctly, but 2 months later I found two cashier's checks for $50,000 apiece in a pile of papers he had delayed giving me. In his grief, other important documents were constantly misplaced as well. Papers that had been sent to him by publishers, accountants, lawyers, and banks. I also found a large Alaskan gold nugget in the bottom of a file drawer, which I made sure he put into a safety deposit box. In the glove box of his car, he had an envelope containing thousands of dollars in cash. And visiting the safety deposit box with him, I found thousands more in cash. I suggested that he deposit a lot of that cash to one of his bank accounts, which he did. Prior to my involvement in my father's financial affairs, he had incurred a heavy debt load, with many items purchased on an installment basis, including motor vehicles, computer equipment, clothing, and other articles. His credit cards were all at or near their limits. He owed a substantial amount of money on the Hana property and had refinanced the Port Townsend place in order to pay for construction at Hana. He had lines of credit at banks, which he dipped into frequently whenever he got in the hole and needed cash. He owed money to the Internal Revenue Service. Frequently we heard him make insulting remarks about the IRS, which had hounded him throughout his writing career. My father had only paid lip service to financial planning without ever really understanding it, and now his tax problems were bigger than ever. As fast as money came in, he spent it on the heavy debt load, especially for ongoing construction at Hana. This left him behind on tax payments to the IRS and caused him to write the sixth Dune book, Chapter House Dune, at least 2 years sooner than he would have done otherwise. While it is true that these books were the most lucrative of any that he wrote, it is not true that he didn't want to write Dune sequels, and that he only did so because he was forced to do so. He loved the Dune universe and enjoyed exploring the many dimensions of the fantastic realm he had created. The classic first novel in the series had been complex and multi-layered, and in the sequels, particularly God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, and Chapter House Dune, he went on intellectual excursions through some of the layers, particularly those of religion, history, politics, and philosophy. But he wanted to complete other projects in between the Dune books, other science fiction stories and novels in other genres. In 1972, he had published a mainstream novel, Soulcatcher. It was a story that touched a special chord in his heart, and he had been intending to write more about the Native Americans' mystical view of the universe. He told Bill Ransom he was looking for another Soulcatcher-like story. Back in the late 1950s, Frank Herbert had attempted to depart from science fiction so that he could write mainstream stories. He did this despite the success of Dragon in the Sea, but could not accomplish the shift. Now, despite the phenomenal success of Dune and its sequels, and even of The White Plague, he longed for other pastures. It wasn't that he didn't enjoy science fiction. In fact, he often said he loved the elbow room for the imagination that the genre provided, and the Dune universe was the most challenging of all. But he wanted to stretch, longed to try new things. Frank Herbert was a risk-taker, an adventurer at heart. On a visit to Port Townsend several weeks later, at the end of March, I found my father still working on Chapter House Dune. It was taking longer than expected. "I've been polishing it," he said, "making it prima." He paused, and his eyes misted over. "For Bev." Around that time, I was reading a book about Alexander the Great. Dad mentioned a number of interesting facts about him, including a unique method Alexander had for timing the charges of his troops. Apparently, Alexander learned of a chemical that could change a red rag to blue in 30 minutes, and he ordered that such chemically treated rags be placed on certain spear tops. "Really?" I said. "I never heard about that." "Yeah. It was the beginning of Alexander's ragtime band." He turned as deep a shade of purple as I've ever seen him, and exploded into gleeful laughter. "He got me pretty good on that one." A short while later, he completed Chapter House Dune and mailed it to New York. A 12-day, 8-city national book tour followed for the new hardcover edition of Heretics of Dune. This book, like others before it, would rocket onto bestseller lists. A hardcover reissue of Dune appeared on bookshelves at the same time and enjoyed brisk sales. Dad took a copy of the work I had done on Man of Two Worlds with him on the tour and reviewed it in hotel rooms, making pencil notations in the margins. During the tour, his forehead was still scaly and blotchy from sunburn and medication, and he had to wear heavy makeup during interviews. When he asked a mainland doctor to check this condition shortly after returning to Port Townsend, he neglected to ask about the big mole on his back, first noticed by Jan. He'd had them before and wasn't overly concerned about this one. "It's probably benign," he assured us. But he was procrastinating on a biopsy, which would determine for certain how dangerous it was. Disturbed by this, Penny, Jan, and I pressed him to get it taken care of quickly. No one could force my father to do anything, however, except my mother. Dad said medical attention for the mole, or benign tumor, as he called it, would have to wait until after the book tour. Los Angeles was one of the cities on the tour, where he was met at the airport by a limousine and driver, and escorted to public appearances by a young woman who was the Putnam Book representative for the area. In mid-April, Dad saw a 3.5-hour rough-cut version of the Dune movie at Universal Studios in Universal City, California. It was a private showing in screening room number 1. This was part of a 4-hour, 50-minute film David Lynch had made, and the producers were ordering more cuts to get it down to a little over 2 hours. Dad was not overly concerned about this, and when he returned home told me he was pleased with the production, that director David Lynch had created a visual feast, capturing the book remarkably well, even more vividly than Dad had imagined when he wrote it. "I hear my dialogue all through it," he said. Dad also said Putnam wanted us to do a joint book tour on Man of Two Worlds sometime in late 1985 or early 1986, when the book was published. While I was still grieving for my mother, I had lunch with Dad in an Italian restaurant in Seattle late in April 1984. He was just back from a triumphant Heretics of Dune book tour, and I was happy for him. He had worked hard to achieve such success. We were at a small window table in the Capitol Hill district of the city. A street wound up the hillside outside our window, with cars rolling by. Dad's forehead was raw and scaly, worse in appearance than before, and he said he expected to be taking the skin medication for another 2 weeks. We spoke of religion, and agreed that it seemed ridiculous for so many religious systems to contend that they had the one and only path to God. This was, of course, one of the subjects covered in an appendix of Dune, where the CET, Commission of Ecumenical Translators, was said to have held a meeting among representatives of the major religions, at which they set a common goal. "We are here to remove a primary weapon from the hands of disputant religions. That weapon? The claim to possession of the one and only revelation." Without a title yet, I had in mind a story about the terrible things religions could make people do to one another, purportedly in the name of God. In the beginning of the tale, God would announce his location on a planet far across the universe and would invite people to come and visit him, for an unexplained purpose. The competing religions would then race for God, stopping at nothing, including murder, to get there first. "There's your title," he exclaimed. "The Race for God." He was right. It was a good title. I added it to a file full of notes that I hoped to work on soon. We discussed two other story ideas, one of mine and one of his, with thoughts about collaborating on them someday, after the completion of Man of Two Worlds. He said he was impressed with the work I had done on our collaboration, especially descriptive passages of the alien planet Draenor and its people, through whose imagination the entire universe was sustained. He wanted to include those passages as I had written them, without revision. Dad fell silent for a long while, then cleared his throat. Nervously, he told me he had fallen in love with the Putnam book representative he had met in Los Angeles while on his Heretics tour. "I hope you aren't going to be upset about this," he said. "But she's only 27. She's an old 27, though." He added that this was in reference to her maturity, not to the way she looked, and didn't reveal her name. From across the table, I noticed my father's eyes gave him the appearance of a guilt-consumed child looking painfully at an adult, fearful of impending punishment. He seemed to be waiting for my criticism. Dad was 63 years old. He was approximately 36 years older than she was, which happened to be my age. I was, to say the least, shocked. Trying to hide my feelings for his sake, I said, "You're not really that far apart in age, Dad. If we accept the fact of genetic memory that you've written about in Dune, you're 5,000,063 years old, while she's 5,000,027. This pleased him exceedingly, and he beamed from ear to ear. Soon I heard the story repeated back to me by other members of the family. He admitted that the young woman was not responding to his advances, though she seemed to like him. He thought it might take time, and then added that there were two other women of interest in his life, both of whom were in their mid-40s. Until now, I had not given much thought to the idea of him remarrying. My father described an unusual experience during his last flight from Los Angeles to Seattle. On the plane, he was recalling the young book representative, thinking of the way she moved her hands and touched his arm. Somehow he was convinced he was picking these memories up as bits of data from her brain, what metaphysical philosophers called petite perception, Simultaneously, he received messages from my mother in which she told him, "It's all right. She's the one. You're still alive, Frank. Live your life." Frank Herbert was not the only one of us to report the paranormal influence of my mother after her death. When Margot was 8 years old, she was about to step in front of a truck on a busy street. Suddenly she felt a gasp of air that pushed her back onto the sidewalk to safety. No one was near her. Thinking back, however, she recalled seeing a dark-haired woman beside her just before the incident. Years later, as I was completing this biography, I was contacted by Frankie Goodwin, who had been Mom's best friend back in the 1940s. Frankie filled in details on the courtship of my parents. Then she added, "I don't know what made me write to you after all these years." I smiled and said, "My mother had a hand in this." As proof, I described a number of events to Frankie, many of which are detailed later in this biography. I looked away as he spoke, trying to keep my composure. Presently, I looked back at him and smiled reassuringly. "Then it's all right," I said. As days passed, however, I became angry with my father about his love interests, and so did Jan. We said nothing to him about it, but it seemed to us that he hadn't waited long enough, hadn't spent enough time grieving. But when my mother passed away, we were beginning to realize a terrible feeling of loneliness came over Frank Herbert. He had lost his lifelong companion, his reason for living, his true best friend. We tried to empathize, but it was not easy, for a lot of reasons. Dad seemed terribly fragile, helpless, and lonely. He was vulnerable. He telephoned me constantly, and it seemed that he needed to hear someone's voice all the time. This wasn't at all like a writer, perhaps, who should have been accustomed to cloistering himself in his study. In becoming a writer myself, however, I began to realize what he must have been feeling. When my mother lived with him, he could confine himself for hours without speaking to her, feeling great serenity because he knew she was there, just outside his door. It became quite different when someone was not physically nearby, not waiting to give him love and reassurance. I knew he had been dependent upon my mother, so I expected him to be very low about her death. Since he always kept guns around, we worried about suicide and about a serious disease overtaking him, brought on by stress. Medical studies showed that losing a spouse was the number one creator of stress. But Dad had always been a strong man, and I expected him to bounce back. I thought his writing would carry him far into old age. But it wasn't working out the way I had expected. He didn't seem to have his heart in it anymore. Howie Hansen, with his Native American perspective, later said, "Frank was a genius, and Bev was equal to but different from him. She had more power than he had. He was only a shell after she died." At times, Dad's telephoning drove me crazy. He called me at all hours for minor things, pulling me out of my writing, shattering my concentration. He had a speed dialer on his telephone with my name on it. While I considered this a compliment, since he depended on me so much, there was a definite downside. If someone in my household was on the line, and my two oldest daughters did talk on the phone a lot, he contacted the operator and put through an emergency call. Call waiting service was not available from the phone company at the time. None of his calls were emergencies, not even close. He needed paper products from a store in Seattle. Would we pick them up and bring them to Port Townsend? Or had we seen a certain politician talking on television? That guy was dangerous, and we shouldn't think of voting for him in November. An ingenious man, my father developed a habit of calling me at 5:30 a.m., when he knew no one would be on the line. One morning, Jan answered the phone, then woke me up. I stumbled downstairs in my bathrobe, half asleep. "Hello," I said. A dial tone greeted me. When I finally got through to Dad, 45 minutes later, he told me he hung up to take a call on his other line from an East Coast reporter who wanted to interview him. When I asked him what he was calling me about, he went into a plot point about Man of Two Worlds and asked my opinion. I wasn't sure why this conversation couldn't have occurred at a more civil hour, but I gave him my thoughts about the story question, not mentioning something else that was on my mind. Afterward, I returned to bed, but couldn't go back to sleep. All that day, I was too tired to write and could only muddle through my insurance agency tasks. Since Dad gave me very little story copy that he had written during the year, I could only presume that he wrote material and subsequently threw it away. He probably rose early to work on Man of Two Worlds, ran into distractions, and then could not proceed. At one point, he told me that I might have to write the entire book myself, with him adding finishing touches.
Dad still hadn't gone in to get the mole on his back removed, and the skin condition on his face could be more serious than he was letting on.
It was becoming obvious that he had neglected his own health while caring for Mom's. Whenever we visited him, we brought along homemade soups, pasta dishes, desserts, and other foods that we knew he liked. We stocked his freezer with them, so whenever he was alone, he could at least know people who loved him had prepared something for his table. Gradually, the scaliness on his face cleared, and he began to look much better. But he was more nervous than ever, constantly in a state of hyperactivity. With Mom gone, much of his behavior became erratic. He had lost her steadying influence. Many of his discussions about new women in his life seemed immature, as if he were a teenager involved in the dating game. Once, unable to find a bag of unsalted potato chips for me in the Port Townsend Safeway, he went into a tirade at the check stand, announcing that he would shut Safeway down if they didn't pay attention to what he wanted. And his habit of nitpicking, which so bedeviled me when I lived with him, actually worsened. It was all odd. The behavior of a man whose mental health was on the edge, in danger of plunging over a precipice from which he might not return. And understandably so, considering the magnitude of his loss. He was a great and loving man, and his flaws were infinitesimal. If I ever raised my voice to him, only slightly, he nearly fell apart. So I went overboard to avoid hurting his feelings. Jan and I told the children he was going through a difficult time, and that they should try to do whatever he wanted, being as understanding as possible. One weekend, Dad raved about my children constantly leaving his kitchen drawers open and about me leaving a cereal bowl in Mom's office where I had been working on his accounts. Holding the bowl in my hands, I asked him humbly if he might find it somewhere in his heart to forgive me. Suddenly, he laughed heartily. Thank goodness he retained his sense of humor. On a beautiful, clear day, he and I went sailing on the Caledan. We didn't encounter a lot of wind, but got the boat up to 6 knots on the jib alone, without the mainsail. Afterward, I joked in the car that I couldn't have done anything wrong, as Dad had not yelled at me once. I overlooked a lot of things, he said, with a wry smile. For much of 1984, he was not writing productively. The screenplays on The Santa Roga Barrier and Soul Catcher remained in his to-do file, as did much of our collaboration. While Jan was in Paris at the Sorbonne that summer, he wrote to her. Dear Jan, your card from the Monet home makes me want to go there at once. I intend to see it in 1985, because I still have this dream of spending most of a year in Paris. I'm getting back into the book Brian and I are doing. I went through my first writer's block recently. Actually, he had experienced writer's blocks before, but not since the late 1950s and early 1960s. I should say semi-block, because I could still do some things. It was partly due to all the pressure I went through doing that sixth Dune book. 6 months' work in 2 months. I got burned out. And then my love life got rocky for a time, but is now back on track. It's an odd thing to have this many beautiful women interested in me. I wonder, of course, how much of it is the glamour and affluence. With one of them, I'm sure it's me. With one, I'm sure it's the glamour, etc. One question mark. Publishers and movie people are yo-yoing me around on promotion gigs. I go to Vancouver, BC next month for a hectic day of radio, TV, and autograph parties. Brian will be up here this evening, and we will get back into the swing of things after he does his usual economic chores. Saturday night, I'm going to a flamenco dance benefit at Fort Worden, and then it's once more into this word processor to make the new book do what it should. The telephone keeps ringing and interrupting. Important stuff, too. I can't ignore it. That was Psychology Today wanting to send a photographer up here. They have the cover of the magazine in mind. I suppose you already know that People Magazine, Washington Magazine, and Pacific Northwest, all of them on the covers. Publishers Weekly with a nice article and picture. New York Times with a wonderful review. Have to build the fence higher and get in a secretary. Have to go back to work now. Stick in there on your Paris project. It will be extremely important to you for the rest of your life. Brian and I are holding down the fort here. Miss you, and are looking forward to your return in August. Love, Frank. Since his personal life was up in the air, he spent a great deal of time thinking about it, trying to decide among the three women, only two of whom were showing overt interest in him. The third, the Putnam Book representative, was not responding as he would have liked. He said that she liked him for himself, not for the glamour or luxury surrounding a famous author, and that he wanted to be more than friends with her. This was the young woman he had met on his Heretics of Dune book tour. Her name was Teresa Shackelford. As for business, it was much the way it had always been. Many times when I asked him about this or that involving his finances, important questions, he threw his hands up and I had to solve whatever it was. His head was in outer space, but not in the productive manner it had been there in the past, not in a manner that would permit him to write the greatest science fiction anyone had ever read. Dad indicated to me that he was having trouble disciplining and motivating himself, and I received the distinct impression that he couldn't write on his own. His collaborator for more than three decades, in a very real sense, had been my mother, Beverly Herbert. Now I was the collaborator, thus attempting to pick up yet another of the important functions of my mother. But a son collaborator business manager can never fulfill the functions of a wife, can never be the source of inspiration and intimate tenderness that my father so desperately needed in his life. He was empty inside, a man with a terrible ache.
To make matters worse, all the Dune movie publicity was generating a steady stream of telephone calls and letters from movie people, reporters, agents, and publishers.
Mom used to screen his calls and correspondence for him, coordinating appointments, allowing him to continue writing without interruption. But now he found himself constantly scattered in his thoughts, unable to concentrate. My mother had been 10 people for him at once. Despite all of his distractions, during our collaboration, the most remarkable transformations would take place in Dad. Only a short while after he had behaved unusually, or immaturely, or distractedly, he would become, quite suddenly, coherent and brilliant in talking about a story scene, teaching me something with almost every sentence. His writing, when he could immerse himself in it, was a refuge from the cares and tribulations of life, from the pain and upset he was enduring in the aftermath of the shelling of his life. As I wrote with this man who had been impatient for much of our relationship, he surprised me by listening patiently to every suggestion I made and agreeing with many of them. Early in our collaboration, Dad spoke of chapter lengths and story cohesion. He wanted to make chapter 1 medium length, chapter 2 short, chapter 3 very short, and chapter 4 long. Thus a rhythm was established in the story. A rhythm he said we could repeat at various points in the book to reflect back to the beginning. One time, when I was spending the weekend with him, I was so bothered by a direction he wanted to take at the beginning of our story that when I went to bed I slept only fitfully. I awoke at 3:30 a.m. and wrote him a long note with my objections and reasons, which I left on the carpet outside his bedroom door. In my opinion, we needed something fast-moving at the start, and too much background information would be required to establish the scene he wanted to do. Later he said he spent 2 hours thinking over my note, and that I triggered his thinking to the correct starting point. A starting point we agreed to use. Chapter 41. This is for Bev. During 1984, we had a number of conferences about Man of Two Worlds. After making an outline, we agreed upon a division of labor in which Dad would write some chapters and I would write others.
In the end, however, he couldn't find the time to do the writing that year, so eventually I went back and wrote his chapters as well.
On my lunch hour at work one day, I wrote around 800 words longhand. That evening, Dad came to my house, and he wanted to see what I had produced. It was too rough to give him, so I sat on the family room couch with his old Olympia portable typewriter atop a drawing board on my lap, while he sat to my left, waiting and reading each page as I completed it. I had carbon paper in the machine, so that we each could have a copy, and pecked at the keys. I knew my typing speed was nowhere near his, but it didn't bother me. Once Kim interrupted me, and Dad told her to leave me alone while I was writing. A few days passed. One day in May, Dad was in a limousine, and on impulse, he told the driver to stop at a drugstore. Dad went inside and got shaving equipment, and shaved off his beard in the car. Jan and I did not know about it yet and were scheduled to meet him at the Ajax Cafe in Hadlock, near Port Townsend. At first, we didn't recognize him as he sat at the table, giggling to himself. Then I noticed something familiar about that man over there. The eyes and hair and the shape of the face. He had a belly laugh over this, and it was pretty funny. But without his luxuriant, distinguished beard, he looked older and smaller. More like a man and less like the myth he had created around himself. When he went on the road without his beard, to conventions and the like, he had fun playing tricks on people he had known for years. Often they didn't recognize him at all until they heard his deep, resonant voice, or until he laughed in the wonderful way only my father could laugh. Arthur C. Clarke mailed him 2 tickets to the world premiere of 2010, held at a theater in Westwood, near Los Angeles. In the restroom, Dad saw Ray Bradbury and said, "Hi, Ray." Bradbury responded dispassionately, "Oh, hello." "You don't recognize me, do you?" Dad said, with an impish smile. Bradbury leaned close, then closer. He looked at the eyes, combining them with the characteristic timbre and cadence of the voice. "Frank?" he said. "Are you Frank Herbert?" Early in June, Dad caught a morning flight from Port Townsend to Seattle. I picked him up and drove him across the Evergreen Point floating bridge to Group Health Hospital in Redmond, where he checked in for surgery on the mole on his back. Then I returned to work. At noon, I brought him grilled chicken breasts, pasta salad, and Italian fish and chips from Osteria Michele in Seattle, a restaurant he liked. As I did this, I thought of all the times he had gone out and obtained goodies for Mom while she was in hospital. Now I was doing for him what he had done for her, setting things up with the nurses, having them refrigerate what was left, and warming it in the microwave when he wanted it. Dad made the nurse give him each of his vital signs, and this seemed to irritate her. Most patients were content to let the medical staff do their thing, but not my father. He wanted to know what they were doing each step of the way. When I arrived at the hospital at noon the following day to help him check out, he was pacing the hallway by his room, champing at the bit to get going. He said the growth on his back, now removed, had been a tumor, but thankfully it was benign, confirmed by a biopsy. Dad was elated.
"Benign is the most beautiful word in the English language," he said.
My father was right, and I thought of the ugly sound of its antonym, malignant. He underwent a complete medical checkup, and the results were good. I had been noticing, however, that his head frequently shook from side to side. It was involuntary and almost imperceptible, a condition I first began to notice in 1977 at his mother's funeral. I assumed it was just fatigue. One Thursday when Jan was still in Paris, Dad needed me to come up to Port Townsend to help him with a number of banking tasks that could only be done when the bank was open. It was on short notice, but after making arrangements at work, I picked up my daughters and we all drove to Port Townsend for a long weekend. The next morning, Dad went into Port Townsend with me, and we did the banking and ran a number of errands. He was cheerful and obviously well-liked by shop owners and people he saw on the street. He even held the door open for 2 teetering old ladies. On the way home, however, he drove the city streets like a madman, passing 1 car at the crest of a hill and then tailgating a pickup truck while beeping his horn at the driver for going too slowly. On a cool, rainy afternoon that year, Dad was driving his Mercedes coupe through Port Townsend when he saw an old woman pulling a heavy cart of groceries up a hill. He stopped and assisted her, loading her things into the trunk and helping her into the front seat. She was wet and shivering. While carrying her groceries into her tiny, cluttered house, he asked why she didn't ride the bus, since it ran close to where she lived. She said she barely had enough money for groceries. It was cold in her house, and he learned that her heating oil tank was empty. The next day, Dad put money into a bank account for her so that she could always afford to ride the bus. He also made arrangements with the local heating oil company to pay the bills for her and for other needy people in the area so that they would not freeze during the winter. He did it all anonymously. One Sunday morning in July, after I had been working on Dad's accounts far into the night, he popped his head into the guest bedroom where I was sleeping and woke me. It was early, and I was groggy. "Do you want to go to breakfast with me and Kyle MacLachlan?" he asked. I knew he was referring to the young actor who was playing the lead role of Paul Atreides in the Dune movie. "No," I said, and I rolled over and went back to sleep. Julie did accompany her grandfather, and it was thrilling for her. They ate at a pancake restaurant in Port Townsend, and she returned with a movie poster signed by both the actor and her grandfather. Dad gave other signed posters to the rest of us. We were scheduled to hold the service for Mom in Hawaii on the first anniversary of her death, the following February. The delay was primarily due to my inability to fly, making it necessary for me to find a ship for the passage. This was not an easy task, due to a downturn in the number of cruise ships that were operating. When Dad heard about my difficulties, he said he would have a doctor fill me with tranquilizers and pour me on a plane. He tried to encourage me to take a fear of flying course, but I declined. In an attempt to avoid a discussion of the subject, I said I didn't feel like hurrying from one place to another. I said Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury did not like to fly either, but were pretty good science fiction writers. "I fly, and I'm a better writer than both of them," Dad said. After trying many travel agents unsuccessfully, Jan found a cruise line with a ship that could take me, and she made reservations. Toward the end of the summer, I left my lucrative insurance agency job to work for my father, receiving a salary from him for the first time. Dad also made arrangements with Penny and Ron to make them caretakers of the Port Townsend property, which Dad planned to keep. They would wrap up affairs in California and move north early in 1985. Frank Herbert was drawing his family close around him, as Beverly wanted. Around this time, he was in close contact with the renowned mountain climber Jim Whittaker, who lived in Port Townsend and had been the first American to climb Mount Everest back in 1963. Dad wanted to go on an expedition to the Himalayas in the spring of 1986 before the monsoon season, doing a documentary film on the trip. He intended to fly to Kathmandu, capital of Nepal. In Kathmandu, he would visit the old royal palace and a number of nearby Buddhist temples, including the spectacular Taleju Temple. The Gurkha regiments of the British Indian Army came from that part of the world, he said, troops that had been of special interest to him for years. Dad fixed dinner in Port Townsend for Whittaker, and together they drafted a letter to Nawang Gombu in India, a man only 5 feet tall who had been Whittaker's Sherpa guide in the 1963 Everest assault. On the very first ascent of Everest, by Sir Edmund Hillary of Great Britain in 1953, Gombu had been a 17-year-old porter. In 1955, Gombu reached the top of the mountain for the second time, the first person to accomplish the ascent twice. He was also a nephew of Tenzing Norgay, the famous Sherpa guide who reached the top of the mountain at the same time as Hillary. For my father's purposes, Gombu, now 48, appeared to be a fine choice. Gombu responded positively, and they made plans to make a 19-day, 200-mile trek in the Everest base camp region on the Nepal side of the mountain. From Kathmandu, they would fly to the town of Namche Bazaar, at an elevation of 11,300 feet. From there, accompanied by porters, they would hike to the lakeside village of Gokyo at 15,720 feet, and then up to the top of Gokyo Ridge at 18,000 feet, for a 360-degree panoramic view of the upper Gokyo Valley, the massive Ngozumpa Glacier, and three mountain peaks rising between 25,990 and 27,826 feet. They would ascend afterward to Gokyo. A climb to Chola Pass at 17,783 feet would follow, and then across the high scenic pasture of Dzongla. Toward the end of the trek, they would climb to the highest point, the top of Upper Kalapatar at 18,450 feet, from which point they would be able to see the South Col of Everest. Dad invited me to participate in the trek, with a caveat because of the altitude at which we would be climbing. "Get yourself in shape for this one." He went on to talk about the dangers of altitude sickness, and of the many trekkers in the Himalayas who would die of this. It was especially important to acclimatize yourself to altitude, he said, and to ascend gradually and go back down at the first symptoms of illness. Many people disregarded warning signs, he said, and died as a result. I wanted to go on the trip and began thinking about how I might travel by surface to Asia. Even if I managed to get to Kathmandu by surface, and I wasn't sure if I could do that, Dad planned to fly from there to Namche Bazaar, and there might be other connections by small plane. It all sounded perilous, but tremendously exciting. Late in 1985, just before the trip, he intended to live at an altitude of 8,000 feet in Switzerland for a month to build up the hemoglobins in his blood. And following the Everest base camp trek, perhaps a year later, Dad hoped to return to the Himalayas, becoming the oldest man to ever climb Mount Everest at 29,028 feet. Around this time, my father, almost 64 years old, began talking about buying a new Porsche. I vowed to myself I would never get in such a vehicle with him, for obvious reasons. Recently, he had gotten a ticket for going more than 60 miles an hour on city streets. He also made arrangements to rent a nice apartment near the Strand in the Los Angeles area, Manhattan Beach, so that he could work on the two screenplays near Hollywood and be around many of the people who were putting the finishing touches on the Dune movie. He had the Hollywood bug, and even spoke of directing a film one day. But above all, he had fallen completely in love with the Putnam Book representative, Teresa Shackelford, who lived in the Los Angeles area. He wanted to spend more time with her, with the object of marriage. She was now 28 years old. My father was emerging into his second youth, desperately attempting to grab another chance at life. He fell in love with a young woman, wanted to drive fast cars and climb mountains. He and Teresa took skin diving lessons, and Dad developed a liking for popular music, especially the songs of Engelbert Humperdinck. One day my father asked Penny, "When you were so in love with Ron after meeting him, did you have butterflies in your stomach and hear bells ringing?" "That was a long time ago," Penny said. "I don't remember." "Well, that's the way I feel now," Dad said. In early September 1984, I helped Dad move some of his things out of Xanadu into a big yellow Ryder rental truck, which he was having driven to California. He would accompany the truck, driving his Mercedes coupe. It was an interesting scene, watching this famous man do once more what we had done so many times in my youth when we were poor, packing boxes with a shoehorn and moving. He still had his remarkable strength and endurance, and hardly broke a sweat as he ran in and out of the house carrying heavy boxes and other articles. He was planning to keep both the Port Townsend and Hawaii houses. While he was in California, he wanted me to go to Port Townsend once a week to pick up his mail, handling what I could myself and sending the rest to him. All during 1984, the Dune movie was advertised as the greatest film production